This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Nobody has done more for the black community than Donald Trump. And if you look, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln, possible exception, but the exception of Abraham Lincoln, nobody has done what I've done.
And the first time he said that, it was almost like he was joking. But as so often the case, he stuck with the formulation, not since Abraham Lincoln. The contradiction is beyond description. While bragging about his ostensible support from black voters, Trump has encouraged a politics of white grievance and white identity, and the likes of which we haven't heard from a national political figure, perhaps since George Wallace. The New Yorker's Andrew Morantz and Kianga Yamada Taylor talk with me about race in the Trump era.
I remember when he, in response to Elijah Cummings, that Baltimore is a rat and rodent infested city that no human being would want to live in. I mean, this is a kind of casual, disgusting racism that you certainly don't expect from the most powerful political seat in the world. And so what flows from that is the confidence of the kind of violent fringe right. They're being activated by Trump's encouragement to then come from beneath the rocks out into the open.
Well, what about you, Andrew? In 2016, you just took on a new beat covering what was then called the alt-right. What kind of reactions did you see online from these far-right groups and white supremacists when Trump was initially elected?
Well, yeah, I mean, Kianga's definitely right. They were certainly activated and energized. That's not even a question. But part of my goal was not merely to look at the sort of lurid fringes, as we're saying, but to look at how they're connected to the rest of the body politic.
And what did your reporting tell you as you got to know people?
I think sometimes it's more conscious than other times. Some people are useful idiots. Other people know exactly what they're doing. There's all this scholarship about how if you just come out and say, "Hi, I'm from the Ku Klux Klan," you know, your mass support goes down to 4 or 5%. But if you say, "I'm concerned about immigration," or, you know, "I'm concerned about states' rights," or whatever the code of the day is, you can get more than half the country to go along with you. You see Stephen Miller saying, "Well, yes, I want, you know, I only want English speakers to come to this country as immigrants. But, you know, there are English speakers in Ghana. There are English speakers in India." It's like, come on, anybody who pays attention knows that what he's saying is he wants the country to be more white. It sort of seems like unless he comes out and says, "I am a white nationalist," he keeps a large swath of support. Now, people don't want you to say things that overtly that they feel uncomfortable about themselves. You know, white people in the crowd don't want to be made to feel that they themselves are racist. But our definition of racism has become so narrowed over time that if you don't say, "I have hate in my heart," somehow there's a wide swath of the American public that will let you get away with it.
Kianga, there have been any number of policies in this first term or final term, we don't know yet, of Donald Trump that impact communities of color in particularly and in a really hard-hit way. Can you talk about one or two of them that have had really serious implications for black and brown people and will for years to come?
what we're seeing now in terms of federal neglect regarding the pandemic. Here we have, by the end of this year, COVID will be the third leading cause of death for Black people in this country. We have yet to have the federal government stabilize a response not just the pandemic itself, but its reverberations. So Black unemployment remains somewhere between 13 and 14%. Black children are bearing the disproportionate brunt of not just schools not being able to reopen, but the ways that inequality shape the impact of remote education. The crisis around housing, the crisis of evictions, all of these will be having disproportionate impacts among African Americans. And the response from the government, which is simply to throw the hands up and say, we're just going to ride this out and basically not intervene, the impact on Black people in this country is catastrophic and will not just simply end if Donald Trump is voted out of office and leaves in mid-January.
Andrew, last year you did a story for the Radio Hour about a young woman who had reached out to you because of your writing for us about the alt-right. Samantha was her name. Samantha had been in a white nationalist group and she decided to get out.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time talking to this woman, Samantha, had been canvassing for Obama and had considered herself sort of a middle of the road liberal, and then started ending up in this online social set of people who were going on 4chan and posting all kinds of jokes about Jews and people of color and whatever. And it all felt very alienating at first, but eventually she started listening to some of their podcasts and watching some of their videos, and she kind of got sucked in.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story because she described to you her conversion in a short period of time from the political mainstream to really ugly extremism. I want to play a scene here where Samantha talks about a gathering that she attended with Richard Spencer, the white nationalist or neo-Nazi leader.
And this one kid just said, Sieg. And another kid said, Heil. And they're pointing at Richard Spencer with this stiff-armed Nazi salute.
It started with like, hail victory, or Sieg, and then everyone would say Heil, Sieg, Heil, Sieg, Heil. I don't know, there was just this energy in the room. It was palpable, like you could have eaten it. It was so intense.
Sam had this moment of like, she always said that she wasn't into Nazi stuff. And that was over the line and that was inappropriate. And yet now she's in this room where there's just dozens and dozens of people like at this fever pitch of like doing this kind of ritualistic thing. This is the one thing they're not supposed to do. This is the one thing they can't do in public. And they are high on the just sort of transgressive energy of it. And Sam describes this one moment where she looks over and sees Richard Spencer as this is happening. And he looks back at her and gives her this sort of raised eyebrow look, like, so, are you going to do it?
He was staring me dead in the eyes. And I did it.
You know, most people don't go this far. Most people don't find themselves in parties in Charlottesville, Virginia with literal Nazis. But it was indicative to me of how there's a sort of slippery slope that people can go down if they're not prepared or inoculated against a lot of the crap that they see on the internet. And to me, obviously the message here is not, you know, parents guard your children so that they don't all become Nazis, because they're not all going to become Nazis. But the issue is that these things are less distant from us than we would like to believe.
Now, can you talk about what Trump's presidency means for people like Samantha, people who are searching for identity or community? How does having a president like Trump reinforce white supremacy in the United States?
You know, Trump is a lot of things at once. So he has authoritarian tendencies. He has these terrifying tendencies. He's also ridiculous and darkly comic in a lot of other ways. So there's always this kind of plausible deniability where people can shift from one to the other and say, oh, I'm just into him as a kind of pop culture punchline, if they don't want to admit that they're into him as a kind of Führer figure. But they, you know, I think beyond Trump, you know, when we still have kind of, I guess, what we'll start to call Trumpism after Trump, there was this Richard Rorty quote, the late philosopher, this quote that started going around, sort of had a mini moment of virality right after Trump's election, where he says, essentially, if we don't pay attention to the needs of the working class, they might get duped by a strong man. And another thing that he said in that passage, which was not sort of stapled to the viral part of it, was that the ways of talking and thinking would usher in this new vacuum for just casual cruelty, the stuff we've been talking about in this conversation. Cruel policies, cruel language, cruel rhetoric, they all are of a piece. So I think
the flip side of the cruel rhetoric is a remark by Donald Trump that he uses now at every rally, that he's done more for the black community than any other president besides Abraham Lincoln. What in God's name, Kyanga, is he referring to? What do you make of that tagline?
Well, I think that Trump is fishing for some loose black votes that are out there. You know, it looks like among black men that his numbers may slightly be higher. And so we have this kind of toxic patriarchal coalition, you know, among a small number of people that really is about, I think, avoiding a larger discussion about the impacts of his policies on most black people, and really, what do we do with what is happening around race and inequality in this country? Because we all get caught up in the fact that Trump makes these outlandish statements and we go chase the statement. And meanwhile, the real discussion about what has happened in black communities that is so devastating that people will engage in a month-long uprising in opposition to it, doesn't get overshadowed, but it becomes less a part of the central discussion while once again we are caught up in the antics of Donald Trump.
Now, a question for you both. Do you think that the Trump experience, these 4 years, has somehow changed what it means to be white, and particularly a white man in the United States? Has his presidency influenced how whiteness is perceived in the broader population?
So I have seen in my reporting, actually, the kind of salience of whiteness to white people seems to have gone up a lot. And that has both helpful effects and also very scary, deleterious effects, right? You have people on the left who are now sort of getting used to thinking of themselves as white and maybe of themselves as having white privilege, which has led to what social scientists have actually called a great awakening, is the term, and, you know, to increased friendliness to the phrase Black Lives Matter and the demands of that movement. Of course, on the other side, you also have people whose increased salience of their own whiteness takes a really scary turn, right, when they start becoming more drawn to sort of proto-white nationalism, or when they start to react to the demographic changes in the country by digging in their heels and trying to protect what's theirs, in this case, their white privilege, rather than seeking to diminish it, they sort of seek to protect it.
I will just say that I think it's wholly contradictory. And, you know, Trump wants to embrace a certain kind of whiteness and white identity and white pride. At the same time, that focus can also obscure what else is happening to white people. And in some ways, it's used to divert attention from what is happening to white people. The life expectancy for ordinary white people has gone into reverse in this country, which doesn't typically happen in the developed world. And it's driven by suicide, opioid addiction, and alcoholism. These are not the attributes of a kind of rising, ascendant whiteness. These are the attributes of crisis and disease and despair and hopelessness. And what Trump does, and I think what in some ways white supremacy from above, what the Republican Party is doing, is engaging in this in such a way as to distract from those deeper questions about what is happening to white America that would cause such deep levels of despair that people are literally drinking and drugging themselves to death to escape the reality of America.
Right, because that would actually be a hard problem to solve, right? Rather than doing easy thing, which is to divide and conquer and to somehow say, I can deliver some intangible benefit to you by making you feel part of the club rather than actually giving you any material benefits.
It's classic, but most of the times it's not being directed from the White House. And that's what's different from Trump. You know, it's not new in the United States in politics for the political class to ignore or to, you know, try to shroud what is happening to poor and working class people. That's not new. What's new is bringing the kind of antics from the fringe into the center of power is also part of the distraction.
Kianga Yamada Taylor and Andrew Morantz of The New Yorker. Election day is Tuesday, and if you haven't voted yet, I hardly need to remind you how important that is. Please vote, and vote safely.